Okay, hi, welcome. All right, so as some of you know, I've lived in Australia for the last 8 months, but in Canada for the last 18 years. And in Canada, where I come from, where I lived, don't come from there, but where I lived, which I lived in Montreal, about an hour's drive outside of Montreal, is a place called Saint-Agathe, which is in the Laurentian Mountains. It's a magnificently beautiful place. There's a lake there and mountains and skiing. In the winter, there's skiing. And for the 2 days of summer, you can do some boating on the lake. It's not frozen. And it's very Jewish. There's a shul there, and under the able stewardship of Rabbi and Mrs. Kahlebach, who run a shul, and they have a girls' school there, a teaching school. And many Jewish people have bought summer homes in that area. So people live in Montreal, and then over the weekends they head up to the mountains to their summer homes. Now, that's what Saint-Agathe looks like today. But back in the 60s, now the 60s is not so far away. It's within living memory of, not my living memory, but of many people that I know. It's in their living memory. And till the 60s, there was a sign at the beginning of Saint-Agathe which said, "No Jews or dogs allowed." That's till the 60s in Canada. Okay, so it makes one pause. But so they tell a story about this couple that were traveling through the Laurentian Mountains, and they came to this hotel which had this awful sign in front of it. And the lady says, the lady is this European, it's a very large Holocaust population in Montreal. So this lady is from Europe, she's a survivor, and it's maybe in the 50s, and she has a thick European accent. You know what a thick European accent is? So she has a thick European accent, and her husband is born in Canada. He speaks like a Canadian. You would say he has an accent, but they maintain over there that he does not have any accent. And this Canadian says to his wife, "Look, if you just keep quiet and don't say a word, let me do all the talking, I'll get us a hotel tonight. Otherwise, it's going to be a very long night." So he goes to the hotel receptionist, and in his fluent Canadian accent, he orders a room, and the receptionist doesn't realize that she's dealing with a Jewish man. And she keeps quiet, doesn't open her mouth, and everything's fine. Anyway, they go, and the room's pleasant enough, and the next morning, they're sitting out at the pool. So she's sunbathing in the pool, at the poolside, and somebody jumps in to the pool, and some cold water goes splashing on her. As soon as the cold water gets on her, she lets out a shriek and she says, "Oy vey!" At which point, everybody looks in horror at her, and she realizes that she's drawn this attention. Everybody's like horrified, and she says, "Whatever that means." So the question is, where have all the Jewish accents gone? And more importantly, where have all the Jews gone? This is across various institutions. Mainstream synagogues, of which I'm the rabbi of one, are reporting universally and across the board all over the world lower attendance rates in shuls. That's cross-denominational. That's whether it's Orthodox, progressive, liberal, conservative, whatever title you want to give it, they're all reporting that. Various Jewish organizations, the JNS, the Magen David Adoms of the world, in the States, the UJAs, the JCCs, the Jewish Community Centers, are all reporting consistently that their memberships are diminishing. The lay leadership of these organizations is becoming older and smaller. less young people are interested in being involved. And it's not really a Jewish phenomena, I guess, although the title of today's talk is Where Have All the Jews Gone? I guess we could extend it also to include other religions, Catholicism, various Christian denominations, certainly in the States and here in Australia, are reporting diminishing attendance and involvement in organizational, religious organizational life. Plus, it's not even religion. There are organizations like Rotary Club and others that are also struggling with the same thing. Lack of leadership, lack of young leadership, lack of fresh ideas, and lack of membership. So where have all the Jews gone, indeed? That's the first question we have to look at. And more importantly, how do we get them back? How do we re-engage them? And that's what I'm going to solve in the next 20 minutes.
So now, you are going to ask us to do something afterwards.
I'm going to ask you to make sure that next week there's a double the crowd that's here this week. So let's start with the Pesach Seder, because the Pesach Seder is probably the second most well-attended Jewish event, even today. Now, and we go back 20 years, you know, in most families, and in 20 years back, I'm just picking a time because that's, I think, a safe assumption to say, 20 years ago, almost every Seder was presided over by a patriarch, who was probably a Holocaust survivor or somebody who came from Europe. I'm talking any Seder in the Western world, in the United States, in Australia. And this patriarch would conduct the Seder in Hebrew, mostly or exclusively. He would conduct the Seder according to the letter of the law, and most of the people in their 30s and 40s, the children of the patriarch, would be quite respectfully bored and disengaged in the whole process. And the kids would be happily running around with their cousins and playing in some other room. And that would describe a Seder. Am I wrong? I mean, can you imagine such a Seder? Okay. Fast forward 20 years, and in most homes, the patriarch is no longer alive, unfortunately. He has passed away, so has his wife. And at that year, the first Pesach Seder, after the patriarch was gone, whichever year it was, and some homes are very fortunate that the patriarch is still around, but in most homes, I would say, that's getting less and less the case. So now, they are stuck with the following question. This is what the family is left with. A, do they make a Seder this year? Without Zaidi around, do we still make a Seder? So what do you think the answer to that question is, by and large?
Yes.
Yes, of course.
Yes. We keep going, right. But we make certain changes. It's not going to be, you know, in America there was a car called a Buick, and they had a very huge marketing problem. Now the car is no longer manufactured. It was a GM car, I believe, but they had a big marketing problem, is that people associated Buicks with old people, so young people wouldn't buy a Buick. So for a long time they came out with a new model, and they had an advertising slogan where they said, it's not your grandfather's Buick. To try and, like, this is not your, this is a cool car, this is not your grandfather's car, right? So I think it wasn't your grandfather's Seder that it morphed into. So what were the changes? What do you think happened? We all agreed that the Seder goes on, the show must go on, but with many changes. What are those changes?
Far less of the religious practices.
Yes, there's been a diminishment of the religious practices in many cases. Some exceptions, they've gone right the opposite way, but the majority, I would say, the religious practices now diminished. Shorter, yes, absolutely. But there's been some other very fundamental shifts.
You were saying that the Zeder was run totally in Hebrew. like it was in our family, you know, and we were sitting, we didn't understand anything for 2 hours. We would just have to sit and not eat and stay hungry.
So what do you think has changed?
We don't do it in Hebrew. We do it, like, you know, we use books.
In a language you can understand.
We didn't also have this amount of books. He had just one book for the whole mishpucha that he would run. And now we have whatever multiple copies you have. And
so different agadas are coming in.
In English, yeah.
And in English. Okay, so there's more English.
Maybe also it's not a tangible thing. It's an aura that used to be associated with it. You know, when Zaidi came from the Holocaust, went through such a... That was your connection with Jewish history.
Yes.
Or our most recent event of Jewish history. And when that's gone, you suddenly feel like, is the connection still there?
But you know, like in our family, that was the only festival that kept this tradition going for everybody.
In many families,
because
that
there was nothing else.
Yeah.
There was nothing. There was no schools, no shul attendance. There was nothing. Just once a year, they got all the family, the whole big mishpucha, and you know, together. And
what country was that?
Tashkent.
Tashkent. Okay. So.
Uzbekistan.
Yeah. So the. I think that there was, you're all right, I think that there was more English, a variety of seders, a variety of haggadahs were introduced, but I think there was an overriding theme, and that was that people began to inject their own personalities into the seder. So whereas probably all our Zaydis had a pretty uniform Seder. They sang the same melodies even, probably. They said the same words, definitely, and did the same practices. I think today you're seeing more like feminist Seders, you're seeing Darfurian Seders, you know, all of the great, you know, Save the Whale Seders, I don't know, whatever, all the great things that people are into, environmental Seders, green Seders. So people are taking their things that they're passionate about, and they're bringing that to the Seder. And
in Melbourne, in Australia.
Well, I'm mostly in the States, I guess. But
this definitely. Oh, yeah.
I'm sure it's happening here as well. I mean, my Seder was pretty religious this year, but then again, it is every year. The point is. Actually, we introduced something very new to our Seder this year. My daughter was born just a few days before Pesach, so that was a new introduction to the Seder. But obviously, my point is that they're trying to introduce their own. Prior to this Seder, there was this Pesach, there was a YouTube video that was going around, and you see like all these people sitting around the Seder. It's, you know, clearly a family of many different generations sitting at a really large Seder table, and all of a sudden these black gospel singers walk in, singing in gospel style, you know, Manishtana, and using Hebrew words, and Moses went down to Egypt land and things of that nature. You know, that's the kind of thing that people are, I don't know about, you know, black gospel singers, but I wouldn't be surprised if that makes an appearance at people's Pesach Seders in greater frequency. And that is actually, to me, the secret of how we can re-engage younger, specifically Jewish people, in their religion and their heritage. But I'm perhaps getting a little ahead of myself. Let me go back to the beginning and start with a quote from Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach, the famous singer rabbi. Rabbi Kalbach once said that he's not worried that there are many Jews for Jesus, which is an organization very powerful in the States, or Moonies, which attracted a disproportionate percentage of Jewish people. I mean, you know, Many.
Should we be worried about it?
What's that?
Should we be worried about it?
No, the Moonies, no, they're gone. They're today was an eclipse of the Moonies. What's that? No, I don't think so. Well, I don't know. Here, I don't think they're as active as they were in the States, in Canada.
There is what they call
Mikvedech Hamikdash,
on Bamber Road, in Hofold.
Well. I don't know. I don't know what they are today, but Kalbach wasn't worried about them. He said he's not worried about Jews for Jesus or Jews for Hare Krishna or Jews for the Moonies of Scientology or Jew-Boos, which are Jewish Buddhists. Okay. He's much more worried about Jews for nothing. And what I think he meant by that is that the greatest threat to Judaism today, in my opinion, is apathy. Let me read you an article that appeared on June the 3rd, so a couple of weeks ago, in Australian Jewish News. This young man writes, I almost entered the communal black hole. Okay? I'm just skipping the article, but I'll read the pertinent parts. I'd been through a Jewish school, and I learned about the land of milk and honey. I went through a youth movement, and I'd been to Israel and seen its many wonders and its many dysfunctions. I led programs on youth movement camps and was an Australasian Union of Jewish Students Orgis activist on university campus. But then the time came to call myself too old. The black hole was attractive. More than three quarters of those I once shared a deep bond with in our communal lives have since gone back into their shells, leaving behind any formal connection they once had to the establishment community. And who can blame them? Now listen to what he says. I would guess there are two main reasons for wandering into this surprisingly comfortable abyss. First, we're tired. After 10 years of Jewish day school and another few years of youth movement or orgies life, my peers are Jewed out, a now well-documented phenomenon. The second, more worrisome factor is disengagement through a lack of options. By that I mean that most of my friends, myself included, could not find a natural home in an existing communal structure. So we are not addressing his and his peers' needs in a Jewish community. So he's not finding a home, he's not finding a comfortable place. What's he saying? He's saying, and this there's a guy who was sponsored by the Bronfmans in the States to spend a year of his life going around and interviewing, I think he interviewed like 1,700 Jewish people of different ages, and he asked them a series of questions about their engagement in their Jewish heritage. And he gave a talk that I went to in Montreal, and it was a fascinating talk. And one of the things that he said is that the younger Jewish population, people in their 20s and 30s, a large part of them are what he called spiritual seekers. They have real questions, and they're not silly. I mean, we educated them in Jewish day schools for years and years and sent them off to university. They're brilliant, bright young people, professionals, etc. And their questions are good. And so they come to the organizations that they think can help them, perhaps their mainstream shul or temple. They come to their, the communal organizations, and they approach them and say, we have these intensely difficult questions that we need to pose. We need to find a forum that we can discuss these very deep and profound questions. And the Jewish organizations say, look, here's a membership form. Mm-hmm. Sign up, give us your credit card, and we'll contact you when our next fundraising dinner is. But don't call us, we'll call you. And then they send them, they take their donation and send them on their merry way. Now, that is similar to probably their parents who asked their grandparents, that's Zaidi at the Pesach Seder, who may have, at different periods, asked them some very difficult questions. Very difficult questions. Very painful. We live in a world with the most painful questions in Jewish history are hanging in the air. They're the elephant in the room. And so they went to their Holocaust survivor parents, that generation, the generation born in Australia, born in the States, spoke without an accent, which was a great point of pride by their European immigrant parents. And they went to their parents and they said, we have these very serious questions. Here they are. Now you are the the religion guru, right? I mean, you conduct our Seder every year and you spend 2 hours. You know a lot about this Jewish stuff. So we're here to find out about this Jewish stuff because we have real serious concerns and questions. So we're going to propose these questions to you, you know, all of it, like 5 years of age. And their parents, or probably our grandparents, felt very uneasy with these questions. These were very difficult questions because they didn't really know the answer. So they said things like, when you're older, you'll understand. Or don't ask any questions. Accept this as fate. And then what happens is the questions become answers. If they're not addressed, then they become answers. And those answers fester and disengage people from this whole thing because they make people feel very uneasy. If you cannot answer these questions or engage them in an intellectually honest way and engage these people in an intellectually honest way, then they're going to look elsewhere. They're going to go to Buddhism and they're going to find an ashram somewhere in India and go meditating on the Bhagavad Gita rather than the Chumash, because the Chumash doesn't have, to, in their mind, any answers to give them that are satisfactory to who they are and to how they think. So what we need to talk about is A, empowerment, and B, enfranchisement, which, if there is such a word. Enfranchisement, what I mean by that is you've got to, back to the Seder, where they're injecting their own personality into the Seder. We have to make sure that our Jewish institutions are able to take that injection of their personality and make it be reflected in the organization. So when young people come along, we can't just have a token young person on a board. And then when they open up their mouth and they ask a question, we do what our Zadie and Bobby did and say, don't ask questions. Because that's very quickly going to make them disinterested. Because they're only there because they think we might have the answer to their questions. And when we're ready to answer the questions, so first of all, you need the right people who know the answers, and or at least are not going to be flustered by a question that they don't know the answer to, who believe that there is an answer out there. And then we need to be totally honest about what Judaism says about any particular thing. So let me tell you one of my favorite stories, after some water. There is a fascinating story. I think I might have shared it once at this forum, but it's worth hearing again if you heard it before, and if you haven't, listen to the story, because it's a very important story. So Chaim is a water carrier in Europe about 100 years ago, a Wassertrager. And now, a water carrier is basically, what do you need? What kind of educational background do you need to be a water carrier? Not much. You need a strong pair of shoulders. You need to be physically strong. Because remember, in those days, there was no plumbing, indoor plumbing. So all your water needs for washing, for drinking, for cooking, all had to be schlepped up, carried from the local river, up the hill, into the shtetl, into the village. And so anyone who wanted to try and earn a livelihood would put a pole on his shoulders with two buckets, water buckets, and go and fill up the water and bring it into the thing. So Chaim is a water carrier like this, and he's one snowy, wintry night, it's freezing cold, and he's been schlepping, you know, ice, I guess, up and down, and he is just exhausted, and he's walking home, his body is racked with pain, and he is tired, and he's mentally fatigued, and he walks past a restaurant. Now, in those days in Europe, the wealthy were extremely wealthy, and the poor were extremely impoverished. There wasn't really a middle class to speak of, and unlike today, where, you know, most people are in the middle somewhere. So he goes to this restaurant, and he's on the outside, and he wipes away the snow, and he peers into this restaurant of wealthy people. And he looks inside, and he's just overwhelmed by what he sees, because there are these fancy aristocracy, this royalty, and they take a little serviette, a napkin, and they place it in the, you know, over here, and they take a knife and a fork, and then he sees the waiters come in, and the waiters are carrying the entree, which is blintzes. So they have like a tray, and on the tray they have these mouth-watering blintzes, and they're carrying it like this, you know, and they place the blintzes in front of these wealthy people, and they take a knife and fork, and they make a little dainty cut with a knife and fork, and they eat these blintzes. I mean, poor old Chaim, he hasn't eaten in a week, and his mouth is watering, and it looks so warm and comfortable inside there that he decides then and there he's going to have blintzes. So he runs home, and he goes to his house, and he calls his wife in. He says, Bela, he says, I want blintzes, just like the people in that fancy restaurant. I want blintzes. So Bela says, sure, no problem. And she, you know, she's a good wife. She runs into the kitchen. She pulls down one of her cookbooks, and she looks inside. And the first ingredient it calls for is a few cups of water. Well, my husband's stuck in the business. Water I have. So she goes and she takes some water and she places the water into the bowl. The next thing is there's some flour. Flour, okay, there's a little bit of flour left over in the house. She goes, she gets some flour, she throws that in. The next thing it says is eggs. She says, eggs? The chicken hasn't hatched an egg in weeks. Well, how are we going to do eggs? They're crazy. Yeah, eggs. No eggs. So she runs out in a panic. And she says to her husband, I don't know. The recipe calls for eggs. And the chicken hasn't laid an egg in weeks. I don't know what to do. So Chaim thinks a little bit to himself. And he says, you know what, Bela? He says, our blintz won't have eggs. Make it without eggs. She goes, you don't mind if it's without eggs? He says, no, won't have eggs. Goes, oh, what a wonderful husband I have. He's so understanding. He's so appreciative. She runs back into the kitchen. The next thing it says, help me out, ladies. Jump in at any time. Next ingredient, cinnamon.
Flour.
I said flour. Flour's in already.
Butter.
Cinnamon's good. Okay, butter, cinnamon. She says, butter, cinnamon, am I the czarina that I should have butter and cinnamon? I mean, who has such things in their home? And she runs out in a panic, and he says, okay, so it won't have butter and it won't have cinnamon. This goes on with every single ingredient. He's like, okay, so our blintz won't have. He gets to the end of the thing, and finally she puts whatever it is, that little pancake, into the oven, and it gets cooking. Meantime, he goes, he has two pairs of clothes, one for Shabbat and one for the weekday. So he dresses in his Shabbat clothes, and he tells his wife to dress. He shows her how to hold the tray, just like the waiters held it, everything, and he puts a napkin over there, and he takes a knife and fork, and he's sitting, and he's waiting, and she brings out the blintz, and she carries it exactly as she's told, and she places it with a flourish onto his plate, and he takes a little a knife and fork, and he cuts a little dainty piece like he sees, and he puts it in his mouth. She's looking, waiting in anticipation, what's he going to say? He's chewing on the thing, he's chewing it, and he looks at her and he says, you know, Bela, I don't get what these rich people see in blintzes. And I think, you know, this generation needs a lot, in my opinion, of what Judaism, authentic Judaism, has to offer. And they sense it. So they look back, they peer into the restaurant, and they look at their grandparents and their great-grandparents, and they've all heard the family legends about how devoted they were to each other till the very end. You know, they didn't leave each other's hospital bed, and, you know, they know that they had good marriages and they were happy, and they, or at least that's what they seemed to be happy, and they seemed, even though life was tough, it seemed that they had a certain peace and tranquility about them that is lacking and that we are searching for today. So they turn to the their temples and their rabbis and their Jewish organizations, and they say, okay, we want some of that. We want to eat those blintzes because it looked really good. So they say, so they go to their rabbi, and if they're unlucky enough, they end up with an Orthodox rabbi, right? So what does he say? He says, okay, so what did they do? They kept kosher. Kept kosher. Is McDonald's kosher? No, McDonald's not kosher. Rabbi, we can't do that. And the rabbi's a nice guy, and he doesn't want to alienate anybody. He says, okay, your blintz won't have kosher. So leave out that ingredient. And then the next person comes along and says, he tells them you have to keep Shabbat. Keep Shabbat? Are you crazy? You've never heard of footy? They didn't have footy in the shtetl. Now we have footy, and the best games are on Shabbos. Absolutely not. No, we can't do that. So the rabbi is very kind and nice, and he says, so your blintz won't have that ingredient. And so it goes. We rob Judaism, we strip it of its spirituality, of its ritual, of all of the ingredients that made it something precious and valuable to the people in the shtetl. And then we give this kind of watered-down Judaism to them, and they take a bite, and they go, I'm all Jewed out. This is crazy. What is all this? I mean, look, I've been trying to chew this pancake for 10 years now. It's enough already. Buddhism is much more exciting than this. It has much more. You know, Buddhism actually speaks about spirituality, and it speaks about universal forces and energies and everything. You know, that stuff's not around in Judaism. And Judaism doesn't believe in God and a soul and everything like that. You know, so we've got to go to Buddhism. That's where the action is at. And off they go. You know, there's a... I'll tell you a fascinating story. There was a woman... who, an Israeli woman, who left Israel after the army, like all good Israelis do, and she went backpacking, and she went to find herself. And she found herself, as most Israelis do, in an ashram in India. And she hooked up with a guru over there, a very charismatic personality, and she delved into his cult, into his religion, and she learned a lot, and she progressed, and he actually offered her to become a priestess in his religion, or some, you know, be inducted into some level of clergy there, whatever it is. And she was very excited because she had worked very diligently and hard to reach this point. And it was a ceremony. They were going to trek up a mountain, and at the top of this holy mountain, they were going to do what they do, and then she would become a priestess in this religion. Just before the date of when she and a few other adherents to this religion were supposed to become this, priestess and priest, her grandmother in Israel got very sick. Now, she was very close to her grandmother, and somehow they got a message to her in India that the grandmother is sick and you should come now if you want to see her. So she figured, look, I could fly to Israel, spend some time in Tel Aviv with grandma, and still be back, you know, within the 2 weeks that the ceremony is going to take place. So she gets onto a plane, she hops off to Israel, she gets to Israel, and there she is. At her grandmother's bedside, and her grandmother passes away, and while she's there, and she is able to observe Shiva with her family. So her father's sitting Shiva, and she's also hanging around. And of course, Shiva's kind of a captive audience. Everybody starts talking, you know, why do you have to go there? You know, you're Israeli. You shouldn't need to go there. You know, just be Israeli, whatever they said. And she said, look, Judaism doesn't hold anything for me. I'm not interested. And many arguments ensued. One time it got a little bit heated. So she said, I'm leaving, I'm going for a walk. So her father says, you know what, I'm going to take a walk with you. And they go for a walk, father and daughter. And they're busy walking, and they happen to pass a shul, a Beit HaKnesset. And the shul is open. Maybe it's between Mincha and Ma'ariv in the afternoon, between the afternoon prayers and the evening prayers. And they walk into the shul. They just decide, let's walk in the shul. And something drives them into the shul. And they walk into the shul, and the rabbi is giving a class. Now, I cannot think of a topic in Judaism that is less controversial than what this rabbi was giving the the class, but this is the topic. You judge me. You tell me how controversial this is. The rabbi was talking about the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. There's a commandment that Jews have that if somebody loses something, you have an obligation to return a lost object. Did I offend anybody? Good. Because this is very offensive stuff, right? The rabbi was saying that if somebody loses something, you lose a wallet. Somebody loses a wallet. If it has some identifying mark, you are obligated by Jewish law to return the wallet to its rightful owner.
That's quite normal. I've done that so often.
Yeah?
Ask for anything.
Yeah, yeah. So, didn't it sound like it was very controversial? Yeah, some commission. So she gets mad. She is furious. And even though she's a stranger in that community, she stands up and she starts screaming, "That is the problem with your religion." Everybody stops, they all look up, what is going on over here? She says, "How come you have to mandate something like that? It's so obvious. Everybody should naturally and automatically return lost objects. The fact that you have to mandate everything and provide a rule for everything, that is the problem with Judaism." The rabbi is a bit taken aback at this attack. As I said, he did not expect this to be a controversial topic, but he starts trying to talk to her and, "Hello, what's your name?" But she is adamant. She storms out of it and she tells her father, "There you go." Encapsulating everything that's wrong with normative classical Judaism. Anyway, her visit comes to a conclusion. She gets back on a plane. She flies back because it's now almost the ceremony. And then she gets back to India and the day comes when the ceremony is about to take place. She goes and they begin this hike. And it's like kind of an all-day hike to get to the top of the mountain. And then there's the ceremony and then there's going to be a half-day hike up the mountain, the ceremony, a half-day hike down the mountain. They're on their way. The guru is in the front, and the few almost new inductees are following behind. And it's a touristy place, so people go up and down this mountain all the time, and some tourist has dropped their wallet on the path. And she finds it. So she picks up the wallet and she says to the guru, "Look what I found. We should try and see whose it is and return it." The guru takes it and says, puts it in his pocket. And he says, "This, the Lord has given us a gift." She was shocked. She said, "But wouldn't it be the right thing to try and, maybe we could find out who the rightful owner is and have it returned." He said, "No. It was in my path, and that the universe has delivered it to me so that I can have it and make use of it." And he just continues walking as if nothing had happened. So she starts falling a little bit behind. Anyway, they get to the top of the mountain, and the ceremony begins. And right at the beginning of the ceremony, the guru asks each one of the potential inductees if they have no doubts and they absolutely want to take this religion. Meantime, she's had a few hours to think about all this, and she remembers the shiur, the class that the rabbi gave in Israel. She's thinking about all this. And then, he asks them and they all say yes, yes. And then the guru gets to her and he says, "Do you want to be inducted into this religion?" And she says, "I'm not sure. I don't know. I have doubts." So he says, "Well, if you have doubts, then, go down the mountain." So he goes down the mountain. She flies back to Israel. And today, she is a religious woman living in Jerusalem with 10 kids. Well, at least when I heard the story, she had 10 kids. She might have more. And the point is that there are, in Judaism, returning lost souls is a very, very important thing.
I thought that the moral was to have the rules. So when you have the strict
exactly.
rules,
and that's how you,
and if you don't have rules, you just
exactly. Well, it's the blintz. Exactly, that is the moral of the story. The blintz, the whole point of the story with the blintz, is that you. Somehow you need to put in all these ingredients. I'll tell you, I had a fascinating discussion about a year ago when I came to Melbourne to investigate the possibility of me moving with my family here to be the rabbi of the shul that I'm the rabbi of today. So I met them and they met me, and there was a series of dinners and at where different members of the community were exposed to me at these dinners, and they asked us questions, and we try to answer. And in one of the dinners, one of the women said, "What would you think about having mixed seating in your synagogue?" Because I think that's more modern. That's where we are now. You know, mixed mm-hmm. seating. So I told the lady, I said, "Okay, I hear what you say, but in the States, they introduced mixed seating in conservative temples and certainly in reform temples many decades ago. So we could easily fast forward. I mean, we don't have to go through the experiment. Somebody did the experiment for us, and we could see how that has worked." Because this lady's point was that if we could have mixed seating, it would attract more people into the synagogue. So I said, "Well, let's test it. Let's look at 100 years of reform history in the United States, where they've been sitting together for 100 years at least. And let's see if that's attracted more people to Judaism, or it served as a door out." And unfortunately, it served more as a door out of Judaism and Jewish life than a door into Jewish life. Those are the facts. So I don't know what it is about having, I have some ideas, but I don't think I really get why separate seating has somehow preserved Judaism for over the millennia. But there's something in there. There's one of those ingredients in the blintz is essential to make it taste good. And I don't know, is it maybe the mixed seating or the separate seating?
I think it's everything.
It is everything, yes. One of the ingredients could be mixed seating. So if we take that ingredient out, because we think it makes sense, what have we lost potentially? What have we thrown away from the blintz potentially by throwing out just that one thing, which made sense to us? We didn't have cinnamon, so we didn't put cinnamon in. And cinnamon is just a small ingredient, but evidently it makes a big difference to blintzes. Not a cook or anything, but it seems to me that it would make a difference. So I think that the answer is, and yes, it is with everything in Judaism. It just so happened that the lady asked that specific question, and that was the best answer I could come up with on the spot. But I think that the blintz story is true of all of Judaism. I think we have to be intellectually honest to our children, and to the youth, the young Jewish community. We have to be open to their questions, open to their input, open to accommodating what they want to change, but not necessarily compromising on some of the core values of what makes Judaism Judaism. And when presented in that way, I think we can have success. I started off at a Pesach Seder, and I'm going to end this talk at a Pesach Seder. This Pesach Seder, a congregant of mine in Montreal, is one of the most Jewish guys you could find. I mean, he called his dog Hunt, and the other one was called Shana Madel. That was his other dog. So Hunt and Shana Madel. I mean, the guy's like so Jewish. Every yahrzeit of anybody, uncles, great uncles, grandparents, parents, all of them, he observed their yahrzeit. He came to shul and he said Kaddish on the anniversary of their passing. He was really a Jewish guy. I mean, he was born in Canada, but he had a European accent. You know, that type of guy. Very successful man, made a fortune in business. And one thing that he did, which was not so Jewish, is he was a bit of a wild cannon as a youth, and this woman took an interest in his life and helped him a lot. I mean, she helped him with his gambling problem and helped him with his drinking problem and everything, and that kind of made a mensch out of him. And she was not Jewish, she was an Italian woman, and in the end they got married. And so she would, out of respect for him, would make a Pesach Seder, amongst other Jewish practices that they did. And the Pesach Seder they had was, they had a long table, and there were her side of the family, which were Italian, his side of the family, and she would make, you know, ham and pork for her side, and matzah and chicken balls for knedlach for his side, and they would have two tables. So it became two tables. One table was with the Jewish table, with the Jewish food, and the other table was the Italian table. And every year after Pesach, we had a standing arrangement. Usher would come to shul, and I would say, "Nu, Usher, which table attracted the most people? The Italian table or the or the Jewish table. And every year he would tell me the same thing. Nobody sat at the Jewish table. Everybody was on the Italian table. And I feel that it is our mission as a Jewish, Jewish people organizationally, me personally as a rabbi, and every individual ambassador, Jewish person is an ambassador for Judaism, whether you like it or not. I think we have an obligation to make sure that the Jewish side of the table remains full. We have an obligation to make sure that all of our organizations are well supported. Obviously, I am very pro-Jewish education. I think that right throughout Jewish history, we have valued education more probably than any other people for a longer amount of time. And we need to do everything in our power to strengthen Jewish education. There's no question. Every Jewish child has a right to know about his or her heritage. However, it's not enough for Jewish children to go to Jewish schools, because education brings knowledge. It does not bring commitment.
Or practice.
Commitment comes from the home. You know, there was a study that they did, Jews that marry out of the faith. 92% of men who married out of the faith and 99% of women who married out of the faith said in the study that they had low or minimum Jewish observance in their homes. You know, there was the Marcus study here in Melbourne that puts the intermarriage rate at about 50% here in Melbourne. And it's even a little higher in people who've gone to Jewish day schools. So it's incredible that that has not been a deterrent to that. Because it cannot only happen in the schools. It needs to happen at homes where Jewish values are taught, and it needs to happen in the shul. So a lot of people said, in the 50s, our shul was packed, because any Jewish exposure that you wanted, that was the only address in town, was the Melbourne Hebrew Congregation. Then in the 50s, the Jewish day school began, which of course is an excellent and a fantastic development for the Jewish community here in Melbourne. But people started substituting. They said, well, since the guys are, our children are having Judaism all week long, they don't need to come to shul anymore. And so all of a sudden, attendance at shul amongst the graduates of the Jewish day schools, or while they were in Jewish day schools, dropped dramatically. And I think that's a huge problem. That's what drove people to the Italian side of the table. And our responsibility is to bolster organizations like our shuls and Shtiblach, and because Shtiblach are very successful, because they do all these things. They allow people to bring, they are honest, they allow people to bring their questions, they give them a safe forum to be able to ask these questions and to get intellectually satisfying answers to these questions, or at least to start a dialogue and to have that dialogue go. They allow people to input their own personalities into those organizations. That's why Shtiblach, Chabad houses are thriving, as everyone else who hasn't figured out what they realize is declining. They are unapologetic about the beauty of Judaism and the greatness of some of the ideas that Judaism has. They present it without watering it down, without taking any of the ingredients out of the blintz, and therefore their side of the Pesach Seder table, their side of the ledger, is thriving. And that's where we need to be. So, questions, comments, concerns?
I'm with the Jewish Community Council, and one of my projects is to get youth engagement up and running. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking how I do that, to provide a forum where people can ask questions and receive honest answers and become involved in the community in a way that relates to them, yes. Like they bring in their own interests.
So to engage them on their terms, not on that.
I just wonder what suggestions you would have for that.
I have a very good example here, which is Spirit Group.
Yes.
Fantastic example. Yeah. They come from Chabad, and you're saying Chabad houses are thriving. Mm-hmm. I go to Chabad, I love it, and I only feel at home with that particular Chabad. I tried lots of different shuls in Melbourne, and I come back to the same place even though it takes me an hour to walk there. Mm-hmm. Because it's warm, it's welcoming, there is a very good ceremonial with my rabbi, you always get something out of it, mm-hmm. you know, and plus it's socializing, you know, I don't know Hebrew, so I mean socializing. But okay, back to spirit grow, you know, it has to, the shuls have to be more than just place of prayer. Like, you know, we are very close now to Brighton Synagogue, my daughter goes there, and when I moved house, I started going there, and I don't like it there.
Me neither.
I feel it very, very cold. Majority of people are older generation, and when I find I don't have anybody to socialize with.
Oh, so you're touching on something very,
you know, it is
absolutely. Well, let me tell you, when a person walks into a room, when any of us walk into a room, like you all walked in today, or the new faces that are here for sure, you walk into the room, the first thing you do subconsciously or maybe even consciously is you look around the room and you say, is this a group of my peers? Are these people at the same stage and age in life that I am? So if you walk into our synagogue today, the Turek Synagogue on an average Shabbat, it's a slightly, I would say, older population of
wiser.
People. So
wiser
population, yes.
And people don't live around that area.
Yeah, so we have
people
certain challenges.
People actually come to Turek, they drive there.
Yes, yes.
So people who actually want to observe, they don't come.
Yes, no, I appreciate that, and that is true. But all I'm saying is that there are some young people that live in the area, and I have been successful in reaching out to them and engaging them on some level. But when I've invited them into a Shabbat service, it's been the first and last time they came. They come because I asked, and they have a relationship with me, so they listen. But I know what's going through their head. They walk in, they look around, they say, there's nobody my age. There's nobody with young children. So, you know, I'll tell you, we once had, we do a lot of entertaining. So we had once two families. One of the families was a very wonderful, established family. It's been for generations, for over 100 years associated with our shul. So that's, you know, really goes back on both sides. And then we had a younger family there. And the younger family was saying, we were discussing, what would bring you back into the shul? Like, what would bring you into the shul, to the younger family? The older couple come every single Shabbat. They're regulars. They never miss. The younger couple, we asked them, you know, what would bring you in? So they said, well, the first thing is, you start at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning, and to get kids up and dressed and breakfast and this and that, and still come there, it's too early. It's too. You have to start at 7 o'clock in the morning. It's on a Saturday, you don't want to do that. So start at 10.
So
the old couple said, you start at 10, that will be the last time I'm ever going there, because we play bowls right after the synagogue, and that's going to go into our bowl. And, you know, everything. So then the younger people said, we would like you to inject more English into the service. So interrupt the Torah reading, for example, to explain what it is, to ask some questions, to dialogue and engage us, right? These are typical things that young people tell me all the time. And then the old person said, no, it would break the decorum of the ancient decorum of this old shul. And that's, you know, that's the challenge. And the challenge is, how do you create... So what I do is, like, I have a class called Kabbalah and Chicken Soup, where it's in my house, it's not in the synagogue. So it's a more warm atmosphere. My wife makes the chicken soup. I try and make the Kabbalah. The chicken soup's really good. And we invite people only in their very late teens or early 20s. So it's a very specific target group. And we have anywhere between 6 and 15 people would come on a night that we hold this. We hold it every 2 weeks. And they come and they stay till very late. But as soon as they walk in, a new face walks in. They take one look around the room, and it's all, you know, these young, hip 20-year-olds, good-looking girls, and, you know, handsome, sporty guys, you know. And they go, oh, maybe either this is my peer group. These are people who are going through the same kind of things as I am. And then the discussion starts, right? And the kind of questions that they ask, oh, well, I don't know if I believe in a God. Prove it to me, you know, prove God exists. And we start going through scientific explanation, this, that. And they're brilliant. I mean, they are absolutely brilliant. I am so overwhelmed by how clever these kids are. and they engaged, and they share things, very personal things, and they all walk away, and then we do some meditation, and some of the guys, you know, bring their guitar and they play things, and it doesn't look like a typical Toorak Shul Melbourne Hebrew congregation service. But that is what, and I think in my mind, I have to keep these separate.
Yeah.
These guys have to be developed separately to those. So did you say you're involved with young?
No, I'm with the JCCV.
Just the JCCV. Does the JCCV have a young JCCV?
No.
There's part of the thing. So you might need to, that's what some organizations have done, where they've created a young JCCV, and it's like a kind of a shadow parliament where they get, you know, but you have to really give them a lot of latitude to make an impact on the organization, but keep them separate. So that way, you know, if they walk, I don't know, are you involved at the board level at JCCV? Okay. So
I'm on staff, but yeah.
But okay, so, I mean, you know, go in your head through a board thing. What
could not be there.
You can't bring a 20-year-old there, right? Okay. So, you know, that's what it is. So you have to, huh? Not a 30-year-old. No, you can't. No, absolutely. You know, so that's what I'm starting to realize, is that I'm starting to segment mm-hmm. my constituents.
It's not fair. Because I'm fine. I can't do it.
What?
I want to.
You want to come to the Kabbalah? You want the chicken soup?
No.
We can make you some chicken soup.
We should be able, we young people, professional, we've got expertise, we've got education, we should be able to make a difference.
They can. I'm telling you, the skill set that these people have is amazing. I'm not, in any way, we want that. We want them to be involved.
Yeah, but how are we going to get them then in the more.
So there's two
of a traditional synagogue. How are we going to get them to come?
You have to introduce spiritual things. Look, you know, the JCCV is an organization, for example, since you mentioned it, that I happen to be a big admirer of. I think they fulfill an amazing, I mean, there are certain organizations when I came to Melbourne that really impressed me, and the JCCV is definitely right at the top of that list. And they do amazing things, let's say political advocacy, representing Jewish and Israel's case to elected officials and all that. Let's just take that. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing. But that's not going to excite young people necessarily. It's something so necessary, and I can see, you know, people in their 50s, 60s could be very engaged in that process, and need to be, and we need it as a community. But that's not going to engage the young people. They're not interested in that, because obviously, like, the JCCV has to be totally apolitical. We don't want to make any enemies, so the community obviously has to not choose a political side, because like every democracy in the world, politics changes hands back and forth, so we have to be neutral. But what's problematic is that young people are not neutral. They're the opposite. They're passionate about different things. And you have to give them an outlet for their passion. Now, typically, as I understand it, and maybe that's just my misunderstanding, the JCCV's mandate is not... Some parts of it, I think, could be very attractive to young people, and some parts not. So you have to, as an organization, and the reason I know so much about what you should do is because I think what I should do in my shul, I'm just speaking to myself here, I'm not speaking to you or anything or anybody else. What I have to do in my shul is really try and figure out what need we can fill with each constituent, and they're going to be different. There's no one size fits all, because we want to attract people to, you know, like attracts like.
Just want to say something. You know, you quoted before the article by Lynn Getro. I read this article.
You read it, right?
Yeah, and while taking out of the context, you know, the...
Yeah, I took out what I wanted from it.
Yeah. Very, very... it's so correct what he's saying,
yeah.
But, you know, do you agree with what he's trying to fill his black hole with?
That's a separate...
and this is...
Yeah, the article is really, that I quoted some excerpts from, is pushing a particular organization which he feels did... resonate with his passions, and he said that's the solution.
I think he's being paid to do that.
It was very.
I feel that he's very seriously misguided.
I don't know much about the organization that he was pushing. I don't even recall it offhand.
I went on the internet. I actually researched it, you know, and I first read about it in the Jewish news from the letters that people were writing. And then I saw this advertisement.
What was the organization, remind me?
New Israel Fund.
Oh, I mean,
it's very dangerous.
Yeah, well, it's very controversial.
It's actually a very, very dangerous organization, and people can get really confused.
Yeah, so I think that, I just took what I wanted out of the article, because I think what I extracted from the article is just typical of what you can pull any 20-year-old off the street, 20-something-year-old Jewish person, and you would get pretty much the same. I just felt it was very representative. That's why I took this extract. Yeah, I'm not advocating anything else from that article.
I would like to make just one comment. Are you aware how busy we are? Because that's another thing, you know, we don't have that much time.
Yes.
So if we come to shul, we want value for money.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, that is a very important point.
Okay,
thank you.
It's just, I want to say that I'm not going to know shul if I don't learn anything.
In our shul, what we've done... Exactly. Exactly. In our shul, what we've done is we've segmented our constituents into three age groups. The oldest of the three, we call the travelers, and that's anyone probably in their late 50s, 60s and older. And the reason we call them the travelers is they're always traveling. It seems to be they're always on a plane or on a cruise somewhere. And most of them are retiring. They've been successful, at least, you know, in our shul. The next group is people in their 30s and 40s who have young children, and we call them the frazzleds. And that's exactly the reason we call them the frazzleds is because they just don't have time, and they're rushing between carpooling and building careers and everything. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, and you have to, and absolutely for those, for all of them, but especially the frazzleds, you have to give value for money. If they're going to donate an hour to come to listen to a class that you're giving, you better give them value for that hour, because that's a very precious hour. Are you going?